If you're doing everything right and you're checking all the boxes, understanding what are the 1, 2, 3, or 4 individual bottlenecks in your metabolism is probably going to be a lot more informative about to how you can get an extra 10 years of high quality life.
Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here.
Yeah, you've been on the podcast for several times, and I always like to refer to you or resort back to you in terms of the finest details and nitty-gritty of all the micronutrients and different metabolic pathways, because I think, yeah, like you're one of the best people out there who just, you know, obviously share such good information about these topics in such a like more simplistically understandable way, but also, yeah, like going much more, or going in like all the detail and, you know, all the in-depth with all these you know, related to metabolic pathways and different kinds of nutrients. So in this episode, I wanted to talk about mostly, you know, what's the role of different kinds of micronutrients and vitamins and minerals for longevity, because, you know, usually people talk about, okay, what foods do I eat? What's the macros and what's the food groups? Is it vegan? Is it keto? Is it carnivore? Is it paleo? Yeah, like what's the actual, I want to talk about like what's the actual like micronutrients and different kinds of, you know, other compounds that are more like, you know, underlying the macronutrients, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I'm the detail guy, so.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, you know, my audience is also very familiar with the idea behind, you know, glycine and methionine, and, you know, protein is probably the biggest thing that comes up when people talk about food and longevity, so that you need to like restrict your protein, eat a low protein diet, because if you eat too much protein, it makes you grow too fast and gives you cancer or those kind of things. So, you know, it's actually many layers deeper than that. Obviously, there's like the amino acids that play different roles in that longevity process. So, yeah, like what's, you know, maybe you can start with like, what's the role of these main amino acids in this, like the glycine and methionine?
Well, I think the first thing that you need to think about is you need to get into a little bit more granular detail when you're talking about what you mean by longevity. Mm. And I think one of the biggest problems in the longevity space is that people focus on longevity at the expense of focusing on what not to die of.
Right.
And you wind up looking at experiments in worms or, you know, if you're lucky, rodents, maybe monkeys sometimes.
Right.
Where the reality is not like the human reality at all. And I'm not talking about that a monkey's not a human or a mouse isn't a human or a worm isn't a human. I'm talking about the fact that in animal experiments, you have highly controlled conditions where they are not likely to die of the things that humans are likely to die of. So if you look at like, number one, what are the proportions of causes of death? And number two, in what sequence do they occur in? Most people are going to die of heart disease or cancer, but if you aren't doing what you need to protect yourself against a physical injury when you're young, there's no point in really optimizing for protection against cancer. You know, at this point, you're lucky. You are very well endowed genetically or very well supported nutritionally, and or just lucky if you get to die of cancer, because that means that you passed through heart disease. Like if you look at what was the leading cause of death over time, it was tuberculosis in the 19th century, and then it became heart disease because people lived long enough to get that. And as emergency medicine became better at treating heart attacks in the moment, it became cancer because having a heart attack was not necessarily a death sentence. Hmm. And when you're thinking about that, in order to get to dying of natural causes, where you might be concerned with this generic longevity factor type of thing that you would be studying in animal experiments, you have to make your way through not dying of physical injury, not dying of diabetes, not dying of respiratory infections, not dying of heart disease, not dying of cancer, et cetera. Mm. And most of us are not even getting there. So if you're looking at something like protein, you want to be thinking first and foremost, what prevents sarcopenia and what prevents osteopenia and osteoporosis. Because if you fall and fracture your hip when you're in your 60s, you're lucky if you make it past the year. according to the longitudinal studies, like, there's a very high mortality rate from just that, right? So it's almost like, why are we even thinking of someone presented an abstract at a conference in a mouse study about methionine and glycine balance before we're thinking of what's the right amount of muscle mass that we want to have? What's the right amount of bone mass that we want to have? And what's the effect of protein on that, right? So I would say, first and foremost, you want a high enough protein intake to maintain high quality bone mass and muscle mass. And you really have to think about this starting young, because peak bone mass is age 25 to 30, and it's all downhill from there. Now, it's not necessarily all downhill at an individual level, because you can come in with lower than normal bone mass and you can fix your diet and fix your training program and you can increase it. But at a population level, you hit peak bone mass at 25 or 30 and then it's just downhill from there. That means that you want to be thinking about this when you're 20 years old, so that you can prepare yourself to have the highest peak muscle and bone mass that you can have when you're 25. And the slowest descent after that, basically. And again, on an individual level, sure, you can become a pro bodybuilder when you're 35 and you can increase your muscle mass. But, like, generally speaking, the trajectory is downward from there. Now, with that said, there is some evidence that in a general longevity sense, you do want a balance between the sulfur amino acids, methionine and cysteine, that are abundant in animal proteins, especially milk and eggs above all, but are much more abundant in animal proteins and plant proteins, and glycine, which is rich in the collagenous tissue of those animal proteins. And the general gist of this is that methionine, too much methionine is going to deplete your glycine. Glycine is protective, in longevity. And if you just look at what was the ancestral intake of animal proteins, I mean, typically you are not even distant ancestors, but typically our great grandparents, at least as recent as great grandparents, probably grandparents, would be largely eating the whole animal, in which half the animal mass basically is collagenous tissues. And so you would naturally have that: if I ate meat, I also ate bone, I also ate skin. And I think one interesting thing is, you brought up at the beginning this debate between vegan versus carnivore versus whatever. In a sense, from the methionine glycine balance standpoint, you have some optionality between the two, because if you eat nose to tail carnivore and you eat vegan, both of those have a pretty decent balance between methionine and glycine. However, vegan, it's hard to get enough. And the vegan bodybuilders are going to come at me for this, but generally speaking, it's harder, much harder to hit your total protein target on a vegan diet. Probably you're not going to be able to do that except protein supplements. And when you start deviating from that, you have to, if you're on pea protein, you're still going to have a better methionine glycine balance than on, like, lean chicken breast. But as you deviate from the whole foods vegan diet, you do have to micromanage your balance more, so you're not as automatically protected as you would be on a sort of whole foods vegan diet. But that is sort of like, well, you better skip over osteopenia and osteoporosis and all those other things in between if you want to leverage that methionine and glycine balance in your vegan diet towards living to 95 or 105.
Right. Yeah, it's like the biggest irony is that you go on this low protein diet to live longer, but then you still die to a hip fracture, you know, in your 70s or 80s, like 65 or something like that already. So yeah, like, you definitely, there's like layers to this longevity thing. Like, yeah, first make sure that you get to, 50s, or, first make sure that you don't die to, like, like some some tragic event that you could prevent, like, you know, not putting a seatbelt on or those kind of things. At any or different ages, you have like different focuses. Like if you're young, then you have to focus on slightly different things, like mostly, you know, building this reservoir of muscle tissue and bone density and other fitness parameters that inevitably do decline with the decades. Even if you're like, you know, elite level athlete, your VO2 max and strength do decline regardless. You decline significantly less than someone who doesn't exercise at all, but it's still going to, it's like, you know, damage control over the course of decades. And if you start at a higher point, and if you like enable yourself to reach a higher point with your muscle strength and muscle mass and VO2 max and bone density, then you fall to a like a higher standard in 5 decades, for example.
Yeah.
But let's say, what is the like reason why excess methionine could be harmful for and in what situations it is let's say negatively impacting health and like longevity?
Well, I think it's easier to say the potential negative effects on health than it is on longevity, just because there's not a whole lot of research in the lifespan front. But when you get too, I mean, if you consume more methionine than you need, part of the negative health impact will be glycine buffering. So what happens is methionine is used to methylate things. And in the process of methylation is what we use for things like synthesizing creatine, synthesizing phosphatidylcholine, regulation of gene expression, regulation and synthesis, regulation and decomposition of various neurotransmitters, and hundreds of different things. And because we use it for so many hundreds of different important things, we need to regulate it. And what happens is when you have a sudden influx of methionine through eating a steak, for example, you will have more methyl groups than you need that come from that methionine, and you will use glycine to buffer them. And if the balance is handleable, you will later salvage those methyl groups in the fasting state. But if the methionine influx is high enough, you're going to run out of your ability to do that recycling, and you're just going to lose the glycine and the methyl groups in the urine. So under those circumstances, you're losing glycine, and that's has all kinds of potential negative health consequences. Glycine is important as an inhibitory neurotransmitter that helps you cool down your body temperature when you sleep, so your sleep could suffer. Glycine is important as a detoxifier, so your detoxification of drugs and environmental toxins and things that you don't want in food chemicals could suffer. For example, salicylates are a compound in food that are detoxified primarily with glycine. And although salicylates are not, the average person can handle them, they also hurt your energy metabolism by poking holes in the mitochondrial respiratory chain and by inhibiting various enzymes. Some people are salicylate sensitive and they get direct symptoms when they consume salicylates. The average person's going to have some kind of decline in their energy metabolism at minimum, even if it's not symptomatic, from not being able to clear those with glycine. There's studies that show that glycine helps stabilize blood sugar. So losing glycine is probably going to compromise your blood sugar handling. And if you look at the list of the top 10 major killers, diabetes is one of those things. And so there could be a relationship there. And glycine is extremely important for your own collagen. And as a result, it's, you know, from a beauty perspective, it's important for like kind of looking like you're not aging too fast, but internally collagen is providing structures around all your internal organs, and it's the major protein in bone. So from the perspective of going back to that list of top 10 killers and seeing osteoporosis on there, it's also going to be important in that respect. Then on top of that, too many sulfur amino acids get metabolized to sulfate, which is good for us. But on the way there, they get metabolized to sulfite, which is highly toxic. And so having chronically elevated sulfite levels is probably going to cause kind of like low level toxicity that could probably elevate inflammation levels, contribute to anxiety problems and all kinds of stuff like that. That's going to maybe not cause a top 10 killer, but still kind of slightly tug on your on your longevity strings in the background.
Yeah, that's and yeah, like glycine has, you know, a ton of many different roles, like glutathione and creatine and heme synthesis and bile acid synthesis. So it's like almost, you know, it's considered a non-essential amino acid, but you know, if you look at it, what it does, and you know, given the fact that your body actually doesn't make that much of it, and most people aren't eating that much glycine either from diet, then it's like you would still, like, most people are like deficient in glycine, actually, at least the standard person who doesn't eat any these glycine rich foods, like, you know, tendons and chicken skin or fish skin and gelatin powder.
Yeah. On top of that, the glycine pathway is basically dependent on carbohydrate and folate. So most glycine is synthesized from pyruvate, which is the end product of glycolysis that you get when you burn carbs. That's converted to serine, and converting serine to glycine requires the unmethylated form of folate. So you need a high folate and B12 intake. And that, you know, the methionine glycine balance is probably going to be worst in people who are low carb, high meat. You know, like a carnivore diet has to have horrible methionine glycine balance if it's like a steak only diet, because you're not only not consuming the glycine rich parts of the animal, but you're also, you have extreme carbohydrate restriction and low folate intake, which are going to trash your endogenous glycine synthesis.
Right. Yeah, unless you're eating actually nose to tail. So in that case, you're,
well, that's why I said a steak only carnivore diet, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You can certainly do a carnivore diet nose to tail for sure. That's sort of like a old kind of like old school Saladino carnivore versus Sean Baker carnivore.
Yeah. Well, I would be interested to know, like, what's their homocysteine levels. I haven't heard that you're sharing those, but yeah, because, you know, if you are not getting enough glycine and you're eating a lot of methionine, then your homocysteine levels will also rise, which is quite harmful.
No, that's not right. So your homocysteine is not going to be a good reflector of methionine glycine balance at all, because if you have an influx of methionine, what glycine does is it takes the methyl group away from methionine to generate homocysteine. So homocysteine is going to be much more linearly track with methionine intake, regardless of glycine.
Okay.
You need B6 to break down the homocysteine. Well, you know, I guess under, so you do need serine or glycine in order to break down homocysteine using the vitamin B6 dependent transsulfuration pathway. So I suppose, I guess you're right, but just not the way that I was thinking about it. So a steak only carnivore diet, the big problem on the homocysteine level it's unrelated to glycine buffering, but it is related to the fact that if your serine and glycine levels are low because A, you're not synthesizing serine from glycolysis, and B, you're not consuming glycine, that is, I mean, there will be serine in meat, so it's not gonna be the worst case scenario, but you're gonna have lower endogenous serine synthesis from carbohydrate, and you don't have the glycine, and so that probably does compromise the transsulfuration pathway. So that might increase, but that you would see that primarily as an increase in postprandial homocysteine rather than fasting homocysteine. In fact, you might argue that in that case, fasting homocysteine would be misleadingly low and make your lab work look better than it is.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah. Because, you know, homocysteine, if it's too high, then it's a cardiovascular disease risk factor. So how, you know, it's obviously not the, like, I don't know, like, how in terms of like the tiers, like how high of a risk factor it is. Obviously, like blood pressure is probably much bigger, or insulin resistance, but like how bad is the high homocysteine if you like have too much methionine?
I guess it depends how high it is. I mean, I don't really think of it like that. I mean, I think of it more like if your homocysteine is high, that's a reflection of the metabolic pathway being backed up.
Mm.
And I take it more of as more of an indicator than otherwise, right? Like if your homocysteine is high because your folate is low, you got bigger problems than just the homocysteine being high. You have a folate deficiency. If your homocysteine is high because your B12 is deficient, you got bigger, you know, like you could do, they don't do this, but like if you did homocysteine plasma apheresis and took the homocysteine out of the plasma and put the plasma back in, that's not going to stop you from having irreversible central nervous system degeneration from the B12 deficiency, right? So yes, homocysteine is a factor because it causes too much homocysteine causes oxidative stress. But I think that's kind of a distraction from the fact that if your homocysteine is high, you got something else that's wrong that has a bunch of other negative effects that you need to figure out.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And by the way, homocysteine can be totally normal and you can have serious problems in your methylation and transsulfuration pathways.
Mm.
And you would never catch them unless you run a more expansive panel.
Mm. Yeah, true. And, you know, obviously when you're talking about methylation, then, or just, you know, methionine itself is, you know, essential nutrient. You don't want to be like too low methionine either, or like you don't want to obviously avoid all methionine. And it's virtually impossible because like all foods have some methionine. So yeah, you just need to.
Yeah, I think that's also like not something that you want to do anyway, because methionine is used to synthesize, for example, glutathione, which is the master cellular antioxidant. It's incredibly important for detoxification. It's used for synthesizing taurine, which is important in the central nervous system, especially. It's used for synthesizing sulfate, which is very important for hormone regulation and for detoxification. So I think from a biochemical perspective, it seems pretty clear that you want a lot of methionine and glycine. And that really also goes back to the, let's take our heads out of the like the generic longevity basket and just think about what's killing people first.
Mm.
You want high protein for good bone mass and good muscle mass.
Yeah. So, okay, so what's
across the board? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, like what's like a good ratio, or like how do you see like an optimal protein structuring for just, you know, maintaining the good muscle mass and also not, you know, doing any harm?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty easy to say how much protein do you need for optimal body composition. I mean, that data suggests that the minimum would be 1.2 grams per kilogram body weight, and the sweet spot is probably closer to double that. If you had a exclusively body composition related goal, you might want to triple it. But if you're just looking at optimal muscle mass, I think you're shooting basically between a half a gram. If you think about your weight in pounds, a half a gram to a gram of protein, of non-collagen protein per pound of body weight, and you multiply that by 2.2 if you're thinking about your weight in kilograms. In terms of balancing with collagen, you could think about it a couple ways. I think as a general rule of thumb, you basically want about a minimum of 15 grams of collagen for every 100 grams of non-collagen animal protein. But I could definitely conceive of the possibility that traditional ancestral intakes were much higher on the glycine side, on the collagen side, just on the basis that the weight of an animal carcass is basically 50-50 in terms of the non-collagen, the collagen-rich animal protein. There's certainly, you have to adjust that for the accessibility, right? Like, so it's certainly easier to eat the muscle meat of an animal than to consume all the collagen that's inside the bone, which requires pulverizing it. And certainly, like, a lot of the collagenous tissue is not super chewable, right? So if you adjust that downward, so if you say like 50% skeletal muscle, 50% collagen rich tissue, you probably got to take the edibility of the collagen rich tissue down to like cut it into a fifth, basically, because you're either boiling it and you're getting whatever comes out in the boil, or you're pulverizing part of the bone, which you're mainly using as a calcium source, et cetera, right? So if you account for the edibility, it's probably going to be somewhere around, every 100 grams of protein gets 20 grams of collagen, something like that. But when I came up with 15 grams of collagen for every 100 grams of non-collagen animal protein, I was also looking at like what would restore the methionine glycine balance of plant foods, and it kind of works out that way. So because there's no randomized controlled trials of different ratios of these things versus longevity,
yeah,
I'm just trying to find like what's the consensus between different types of ways that you would think about it. And so I think when you think about it in multiple different ways, like what would our ancestors get? What would have a kind of consensus balance between whole animal and plants? It all kind of works out like that. But another way to think about it that would allow you to go a little higher would be, what are the potential therapeutic uses of glycine? And if you look at human trials, you're basically looking at 3 to 5 grams with a meal can help stabilize blood sugar. 3 grams before bed can help with sleep. 3 to 5 grams in the context of gelatin. So 15 grams of gelatin, but not lower doses. 15 grams of gelatin has got about 5 grams of glycine in it. In that context, before exercise, it can help collagen synthesis in joints. So if you're kind of combining these, you could say, well, 5 grams with each meal, 3 grams before bed, 5 grams before exercise, then you could argue for like a 20 to 25 gram intake of glycine if you're maximizing the therapeutic value, excluding the studies of schizophrenia using 60 grams. Which, by the way, I believe is like roughly equivalent to what gets turned over in the maximal collagen turnover, which is highly variable between people, but like maximal turnover, like the maximal estimated individual glycine turnover is somewhere around that 60 grams that has been used as an antipsychotic for schizophrenia. But so if you look at it like that, I would say like I would create a window and say the baseline is getting this 5 extra grams of glycine a day from 15 grams of collagen for each 100 grams of non-collagen animal protein in your diet. So that looks like maybe if you're on the upper range of supporting your body composition with the regular, so-called regular protein, maybe you're getting 150 grams a day if you weigh 150 pounds. And then you're adding to that 22 and a half grams of collagen. About a third of that is glycine. And then that's the bottom of the window. And then the top of the window would be maybe 20 to 25 grams of glycine, which you would get from 60 to 75 grams of collagen or gelatin. Or divide that by 10 and you have the cups of bone broth that you would have to drink. Or you could be getting it from glycine powder or whatever. So that, I mean, if you get it from glycine powder, it is that 20 to 25 grams. If you're getting it from any of those other sources, you're looking at 3 times that for the collagen based protein.
I mean, the amount of glycine you could eat is like pretty high per day. I think there are some experiments even like that 90 grams per day is also like pretty safe and no side effects. So, but yeah, like there are maybe like a few side effects of some people, like I've heard them say that, you know, headaches or nausea or something like that. But, you know, that could be because
of that to someone with a glycine cleavage system disorder and you're going to put them in the hospital and they might die. But so there's individual variation in everything. But yeah, yeah, I think that, I mean, the lesson is that take the random person who submits themselves to research studies and doesn't get kicked out at the enrollment process, that person as a prototype is probably going to be able to tolerate a massive amount of glycine.
I mean, there's so many reasons to take glycine, I think, besides, you know, even if there's like, yeah, like no, this methionine thing is, yeah, like doesn't matter, there's, yeah, like just the other benefits for the collagen alone. It's like, you know, you do need, you know, at minimum like 12 grams of glycine for the collagen turnover, and like I said, it could be even like higher, like up to 60 or 36 grams, or yeah, depends on what reference someone uses or what you know, what thoughts or opinions they have about it.
Yeah, but I mean, the big elephant in the room though is that endogenous glycine synthesis is not a constant, and it's going to be highly correlated with carbohydrate intake, the rate of glycolysis, and the availability of tetrahydrofolate, which is the unmethylated form of folate, which requires having a high folate intake and requires a very robust turnover of folate in the methylation system and the other systems that folate is involved in. So if you have a very high flux of folate through those systems, a very high folate intake, and a very high carbohydrate intake, so that you're relying primarily on carbohydrate oxidation, you're probably going to need a lot less glycine. Whereas if you are on a carnivore diet, your glycine needs are going to be way higher because you're kind of maxing, you're bottoming out all those processes, the carbohydrate intake, the folate flux, et cetera.
Mm. Gotcha. You mentioned taurine a little bit while ago, which is interesting or relevant because like a few weeks ago, there was this mouse study that showed that the taurine supplementation extended the lifespan of the mice. So, you know, obviously it's not a human study or anything, but what do you think about of role of taurine and what's like the benefits of taurine, and what do you think of adding it as a supplement?
Well, I didn't see that study, so I'm not too sure. I mean, taurine is it's important for bile acid conjugation, and it's important as a, it's kind of in the central nervous system, it's kind of aligned with GABA. But it also is just an intermediate in transsulfuration. So it's sparing to sulfur amino acids. And it is a precursor to sulfate. Without redoing that study, blocking various different pathways, it's kind of hard to figure out what the living longer part of that is. You know, you might just be inhibiting the transsulfuration process and sparing sulfur amino acids or something like that. I don't know. Sparing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the study, like the human equivalent dose that it took was 3 to 6 grams, where they saw the life extension. And I think the rationale or like the mechanisms was, yeah, like through like some, you know, cardio protection or something like that, or in addition to like other things. But like, you know, part of the reason I think the taurine has like some benefits is also like the heart health benefits, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, there was research in humans going back many decades ago, from like the mid 20th century, where high provision of sulfur compounds was shown to be very protective in humans against heart disease. And I'm pretty sure all the sulfur compounds were interchangeable. And so it was like the hypothesis at that time was that it was from sulfate, because like it didn't matter which sulfur compound you provided, they were all equally protective in the models that they were using.
Mm. Right. And sulfur or sulfate helps with glutathione, like the main mineral for that.
Well, The argument back in the day was that it was helping with cholesterol uptake. So I don't know, did if you saw that mouse study, did they look at the blood lipid levels? Although mice are terrible as models of human blood lipids, but did you did they
No,
look at that?
I didn't recall anything like that. But yeah, like interesting that there is in Japanese at least there is one paper talking about that. You know, the Japanese get a lot of taurine in their diet, and that's you know, part of at least the paper speculated that that's one of the reason why Japanese have like some better longevity. And of course, there's other things that contribute to that, but. Yeah, like the seafood and all the sea vegetables, they're actually the highest source of dietary taurine, or one of the highest sources of
Interesting.
and they're even higher in taurine than like meat and stuff. But yeah, that can be another topic for another discussion, unless you want to like add anything about it.
No, not really. I mean, I guess I would just say that it's like without highlighting the exact mechanism, it's difficult to say where it would fit in the human case, right? Because it's way more humans are dying of discernible causes of disease than are dying of old age. My grandfather died of old age. I mean, he had no particular health problems, and he was like, "Well, I'm gonna be dying soon," and he was like, "I can feel it. God's calling me," and everyone got prepared for a year, and then he was like, "Yep, I'm gonna lay down." And then he asked people to pray over him, and then he just like laid there and gradually lost various functions over the course of a week. But most people don't die like that. Like most people are, they wind up if they either got run over by a car or they had a heart attack or they had a cancer, or they you know what I mean? So I just the longevity studies in animals are not the top thing that I'm going to look at. And I'm not saying there's not a general longevity factor. I'm just saying that you don't even gain the right to be concerned with the general longevity factor until you don't die of an infection, don't die of, that whole list, right? And so it's interesting, and I'd like to know why it is, but like that's just not the first. That's not the that whole field of research is not the going to be the first place I'm going to look for how to live longer.
Right. Yeah, like you obviously the first focus is to avoid the chronic diseases and maintain good health span, if that makes sense, like the living healthier for longer.
Yeah, and on that note, I strongly suspect that after you hit the low-hanging fruit of things that are obviously healthy, what is any given person's personal longevity strategy is probably highly unique to them. Because I think that there's Let me just kind of introduce this topic. So on average, on average, people are each person's carrying one to two clinically relevant rare mutations for a genetic disease, and they don't have a genetic disease because maybe they're heterozygous for it and it's not manifesting as a genetic disease, but it is probably one of the biggest bottlenecks in their metabolism. If that's the case, it probably doesn't matter if the person is eating crap and inside all day and not exercising. But if you're doing everything right and you're checking all the boxes, I think understanding what are the one, two, three, or four highly unique individual bottlenecks in your metabolism is probably going to be a lot more informative about to how you can get an extra 10 years of high quality life than looking at like what increases the group mean lifespan among mice. Because if I mean, let's just, I it's easier to illustrate it with a couple of big examples, right? So you don't want diabetes, right? There's things that obviously increase the risk of diabetes in the general population, and there's obvious reasons why diabetes has become very common in our society, and that's some of the clearly demonstrated like factors are obesity and overweight. Some of the contentious factors are sugar intake. Some of the sort of fringe hypothesis, but maybe true factors are artificial lighting and environmental toxins and all that stuff. But I'll have better numbers on it in the next couple of months because I'm in the midst of analyzing this data, but I'm just going to guesstimate that somewhere around 30% of people probably have a rare mutation that is a unique block in carbohydrate, fat, or protein metabolism. And it's different for each person because there's hundreds of these, right? There's, you know, on the order of 700 or 800 different, like full blown clinical diseases of energy metabolism. And they're all, each one is very rare, but collectively, most people have one or two of these very rare things, right? So like 30% of those are something that's going to fundamentally impair your ability to metabolize a certain amino acid or a certain type of fatty acid or carbohydrate generally, et cetera, right? And so why don't all fat people get diabetes? Why don't all people in America get diabetes? Why don't all people who have office jobs get diabetes? Obviously, it's because of these different things between them, right? And now there's voluminous data on the many, many, many common polymorphisms that might correlate with diabetes risk. But if you're walking around with a, you know, 50% of a defect in a thiamine transporter, you know, your residual risk of getting diabetes after you control for being lean, going outside, being active, and all the general things that we know everyone should do is probably far more determined by the fact that you have cut down your thiamine transport by 50%, such that on a good diet, you will have a thiamine deficiency, right? Like, and that's just one of those things, right? That could be, there could be hundreds of others. And so I think that person, their longevity is probably going to be primarily influenced by thiamine supplementation, right? The fact that taurine can give a little bit of an edge to all mice for that person is probably less important than the fact that they have a unique bottleneck in their energy metabolism that is at the point of thiamine, and that thiamine supplementation is the one thing they can do to fix it. You know, and it, to be clear, if they're obese and they don't exercise and they're indoors all day, et cetera, like they probably don't, thiamine's probably not the thing they should be thinking about. You know, but I mean, we're not talking to that type of person anyway. We're talking to the highly motivated people. And so I think that after you say, okay, I've checked all the boxes to protect myself from injuries, respiratory infections, diabetes, osteoporosis, heart disease, cancer. Now what do I do to get more longevity? I just think it's going to be like the next good 10 years of high quality life that you could add is probably going to come from introspecting on your own uniqueness rather than to the general longevity literature the way I see it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Like genetics is obviously massive, and you know, the centenarians themselves, like they you know, a lot of centenarians do follow like a relatively healthy lifestyle, or they follow the fundamentals. But you know, most of the centenarians, at least I think, the reason they live long is they have like some good genes, or they live in this environment that enables their particular genes to reach their maximum or reach a longer life, if that makes sense. And yeah, like if you have like a particular bad gene, in whatever it is, or there's a bottleneck in whatever it is, pathways, then yeah, like you're gonna be like, you know, not broken, but your body will function at a much lower, you know, efficiency. And yeah, like just fixing that is gonna give you like a massive improvements. And I think like the most, I think most common example most people have heard about is the like the MTHFR gene, so methylation genes. So yeah, like for those people who are like poor methylators, then fixing their or supporting their methylation is going to be like one of the most important things for their, you know, not just longevity, but also like overall health and you know, how they function during daytime.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that though. So the MT, I mean, you could split MTHFR into the thing that everyone's talking about and the thing that I'm talking about. So the thing that everyone's talking about with MTHFR is the common polymorphisms, the C677T and A1298C polymorphisms. The thing is, there's, and I don't have either of them, but I'm one of 13% of people that don't have any of those. And you know, you can add, I mean, I'm not going to say it's not relevant, but the relevance is probably that if you have low MTHFR activity based on those common polymorphisms, you probably need an extra 1.6 milligrams of riboflavin a day. And then you should probably move on to thinking about something else. And that's not to say that, well, look, here's the thing. So if you look at homocysteine levels, and I'm not saying homocysteine is the be all end all of methylation, but it is an index of the function of the MTHFR enzyme, because if you're making enough methylfolate, you're using it to recycle homocysteine. And there's also rare genetic defects in MTHFR that are much stronger, and they're associated with way higher homocysteine levels, like in the hundreds, or for people who are homozygous in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And if you look at C677T, basically, if you are homozygous for it, you have elevated homocysteine. If you are compound heterozygous for C677T and A1298C, you have somewhat lower homocysteine, but it's still higher than normal. And when you get down to one copy of C677T, it's like, maybe your homocysteine's like a little bit high, but it's not very consistent. And people with A1298C who don't have C677T don't have elevations of homocysteine at all. And if you, you know, then you add on the very rare MTHFR mutations where you can get homocysteine up even higher than that, you basically just have a linear inverse correlation between MTHFR activity and homocysteine. So high MTHFR activity is normal homocysteine, and as you go down, you have to kind of get down like 40 or 50% of MTHFR activity to see a rise. And then you just start seeing it rise depending on which mutation you have. The more MTHFR activity goes down, the higher homocysteine goes. And then if you're an edge case with a very severe defect, homocysteine just goes all the way up like that. Right. So why do 87% of people have at least one of these polymorphisms? Obviously, it's because they don't matter that much. And why wouldn't they matter that much? Probably because riboflavin intakes used to be higher in ancestral populations and allowed these mutations to spread without causing harm. Because what the study shows that if you take someone who's homozygous for C677T, if you add 1.6 milligrams of riboflavin to their basal intake of riboflavin, so you're probably bringing it up to somewhere around 3, 3.5 milligrams, total, you abolish the homocysteine rise. And modeling of the enzyme shows that all C677T is just a minor decrease in the binding affinity of the enzyme for the riboflavin. And what the human studies show, the intervention studies in humans, is that that binding activity has got to be off by only a little bit, because only a little bit of riboflavin fixes it, right? So I think you're right that will be a longevity influence if you don't address it. But no one is MTHFR going to be their primary genetic piece of information that's going to be like their primary unlock. And I think that people have a very distorted view of this because of the internet support groups where people with MTHFR get together and they talk about their symptoms and they wind up saying, oh, everyone in this MTHFR group has this, 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 and this. All the studies are wrong. It does so much else. If you do it like that, you can peg anything you want on MTHFR because everyone's got MTHFR. So all you have to do is put the people looking for a support group together into one support group, and pretty much everyone looking for help has MTHFR, except, you know, I would go into a support group and I need help and I wouldn't have MTHFR, but I'm like 13% of people, right? So that just allows people to grossly exaggerate what MTHFR is doing. It's like, you hear some of these stories and you're like, that doesn't happen to 87% of people. So that's not MTHFR. And I'm not saying, again, I don't mean to minimize its importance. Like if you are riboflavin deficient and you have MTHFR, especially if you have other genetic interactions with the methylation pathway, you can wind up having things kind of pile on top of each other in a negative way. In fact, like it's conceivable that someone has there, if you take all the, there's enough common polymorphisms that interact with MTHFR that you can put yourself in the category, if they're all stacked on top of each other, where you've got a 50% decrease in folate uptake into the cell, you've got a 70 something percent decrease in the enzyme that precedes MTHFR, you've got a 75% decrease in MTHFR, and you compound those and you can have a pretty severe deficiency. But that's probably more common than having one of the very severe MTHFR mutations. It's like 1 in 200,000 people are homozygous for them. But it's not that common. What I'm talking about in general is that, let's say you have the severe defects in MTHFR, the rate from newborn screenings of severe MTHFR mutations is 1 in 200,000. No one knows how common it is to be heterozygous for it, but the parents of the babies and children that are found in newborn screening with massively elevated homocysteine, the parents have homocysteine that's on the order of 70s, 80s, 90s. And homocysteine has a very strong anti-fertility effect, which means that the rate of carriers who have homocysteine in the 70s, 80s, 90s, sometimes it's in the 50s, 60s, that's probably a lot higher than you would expect from a back calculation of 1 in 200,000 homozygosity. Because if homocysteine causes infertility, that means that a lot of infertility, and you know, you expect it goes up when people are trying and they get IVF, but you also have to take into account like how much fertility is by accident, right? So like a lot of people don't know the accidental pregnancies that they didn't cause, but it was probably like multiple with multiple people, right? So so the reality is that like there would be a lot, you would probably have a way more, my guess is that you could have 10 or 20 times higher incidence of the heterozygosity for the severe mutation than you would expect from looking at 1 in 200,000 homozygous incidents. And if you look at homocysteine curves, there is a huge rightward skew of the homocysteine curves, meaning it's a bell curve, but then there's this long right tail that is just the little tail of people with crazy high homocysteine levels. And if you're looking at adults in a population that has diabetes, you're looking at that and you're saying, yep, those are the people with poor kidney function because they're not clearing the homocysteine out. But I found a study of high schoolers in Europe where the right tail looked the same. There was 1% of these kids. There's no way on earth this is explainable by a high incidence of renal impairment in high schoolers, right? It's just they're not old enough to have that renal impairment. And there's still a heavy rightward skew of homocysteine where there's just 1% of these people have homocysteine 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And so I think a lot of, I'm not saying all of it, but I think a significant percentage of that could be rare mutations that no one's looking for in MTHFR. And that's the type of thing that I'm talking about, right? So that might be someone's. Mine, as far as I can tell right now, is a mutation in an enzyme called ACAD9, which plays a dual role in fatty acid oxidation and the mitochondrial respiratory chain. And I'm finding that supplementing with riboflavin and altering my macros around that specific mutation is the highest payload thing that I've done in my life, above and beyond the low-hanging fruit of the types of things that I think everyone should do. So I think that there's enough of those that each person is going to have something different, and it's not going to be what anyone's talking about.
Gotcha. Is there a way for the average person to discover those bottlenecks without, you know, having such, you know, you will probably like recognize those things much faster than the average person, or, you know, the average person might do their genetics. They might know if they have the MTHFR or not. They might know if they have like some other bad genes for heart disease or whatever, but how do they go about finding those bottlenecks?
Yeah, they don't. So the best thing that you can do is get whole genome sequencing instead of getting SNP chip genome sequencing. So this is the problem with the genetics that everyone's focusing on. In the SNP chip companies like 23andMe or Ancestry, they're not sequencing your DNA. They are testing you on a binary test for each single nucleotide polymorphism that they're interested in. And the way that they do that is there's basically ink spots for each person in a batch that are splattered onto a chip that they cluster in one direction or the other for being positive or negative for that single nucleotide polymorphism. And the way that the methodology works is they look at the clustering and then they say, okay, this is the dividing line based on how the clustering looks. I mean, it's not a person who does it. It's a computer system, but it looks mathematically at like, oh, people are clustering over here and here's one cluster. So this is the line. These people have G, these people have C, or what, you know, whatever the SNP is, right? The problem with that is that when it's common, it's accurate because you have a robust sample size of people in both clusters. If you're looking for something that's rare, it's anti-accurate because you have almost no one on one side of the chip. And so recent research shows that SNP chips are 84% inaccurate.
Wow.
Meaning they give you the wrong answer 84% of the time when they are looking at something that has an allele frequency less than 1 in 1,000. So on that basis alone, now, if you have something in the report that the company gave you, if it's a rare gene, they probably did like 5 different tests to try to corroborate that they have the correct answer for that. But if it's in your raw data and you import it into some third-party algorithm, you're feeding the algorithm 84% inaccurate data on all the rare stuff. So even if they're including it in a sample like that, you know, so by contrast, the technique that's used in whole genome sequencing is actually looking at what nucleotide is there. And so it's not perfect, but it's, you know, it's above 90% accuracy. And then what they do is they read your genome 30 times, 50 times, 100 times, and upwards of 90% accuracy becomes way upwards of 99, you know, point whatever number of nines accuracy. And you can get a lot out of getting all of, you know, selecting an all reports option. So if you like, usually these companies say like $200 as the baseline for doing your genome, then like $200 for our reports or $50 for one of them. It's like, so if you just get an all report function add on to the basic genome from a whole genome sequencing, and not whole exome sequencing, whole genome sequencing, neither of these are whole anything, but whole exome sequencing is 2% of the genome and whole genome sequencing is 90% of the genome. So it's
nice.
They speak for themselves. The numbers do. So if you just get all like their reports, I think that's a good starting place. But what I'm doing right now, like what I'm in the sort of like the next big thing that I'm working on is, I'm working, I partnered up with someone in my membership program who is a software engineer who, has not commercialized this app yet, but he's letting me use it, and I can upload someone's raw data and then I can go in and I can search by gene and look at every mutation there and see which ones are, cross-referenced with, databases of prediction models of what it does to the gene, databases of clinical reports of disorders associated with that gene. And I can go through and I can say, okay, like within the context of energy metabolism, there's these 20 mutations that stand out, but then we can rate them by, you know, how, like which ones have consistent reports of diseases associated with them in the ClinVar database, which is a clinical variations database where people support putative mutations that are responsible for genetic diseases, which ones are supported by computer modeling that they do something bad. And then like, then I can cross-reference that with the person's lab data and I can say, okay, you have these three genes look particularly bad. These two genes are highly correlated with the weird things in your data that are otherwise not explainable. You know, so I hope there's a way to scale this, but the truth is that I'm doing it at the exceedingly micro scale level now. But that doesn't change the fact that I'm at the point where I would not recommend anyone waste money on a 23andMe from a health perspective these days, because I have seen what the tip of this iceberg looks like in myself and 10 other people. And I've also seen the recent data quantifying, right? Like, so I'm pairing this with recent data from the, what was it called? The million exome study, where they took whole exome sampling, which again is 2% of the genome, not 90%, like whole genome. So this is a gross underestimate of the possible mutations, but they took 1 million people and they looked at the whole exome samples and they said, okay, how many genes in the population are there for things that are associated with rare genetic disorders in the ClinVar database that have a grading of 2 or higher, which a grading of 2 stars in the ClinVar database means there are multiple practitioners who have submitted a report and there's no conflicts between them, right? So if someone says it's pathogenic, someone says it's not pathogenic, it's not 2 stars. But if there's at least 2 different people submitting the reports that both say it's pathogenic, that would be a 2-star rating. So that's where I took the data when I said 1 or 2 people carry something. The average number of rare gene mutations that would not be found in a SNP chip assay, but can be found through whole genome sequencing, that have consistent multiple reports from different submitters in the ClinVar database as being putatively associated with a genetic disease, the average is 1.6 per person. Okay. Now that's from whole exome sequencing. So it's probably an underestimate. So it's probably something like 2 to 4 per person. And that doesn't, I'm not saying like everyone's got 2 genetic diseases. What I'm saying is if there's 2 to 4 of these per person, and let's say that 30% of them pan out to be very significant impacts in metabolism, that means the average person has one bottleneck in their metabolism that grossly outweighs the net result of averaging together the 500,000 polymorphisms that are making things go up or down 5%, right? Like if you, and part of the problem too also is that these things are nonlinear. Okay. So I have, let's go back to me for a second. I have an ACAD 9 that works and I have an ACAD 9 that doesn't work. If the ACAD 9 that works requires 1.3 milligrams of riboflavin per day, and the ACAD 9 that doesn't work requires 400 milligrams of riboflavin per day, I do not have a linear response to riboflavin. I have 50% of ACAD 9 working with the first 1.3 milligrams of riboflavin, and then I need hundreds of milligrams to get the other, some portion of the other 50% to work, right? So this is like a it's sort of like a binary, like you may need to be on a carnivore diet, or you may need to supplement with 500 milligrams of thiamine, or you may need to supplement with 200 milligrams of riboflavin, or you should not use CoQ10, or like just come up with all of these things where it's not a linear response to many things. It's one thing that should be avoided or one thing that should be megadosed. It just makes no sense to me that, we have to deal with the fact that we have not scaled the analysis of these things. It's what I'm working on right now. But I would just say, just like, wait, chill out, like stop micro analyzing, the 500,000 things that are not doing much in you, and focus on like the general principles. And then hopefully we can kind of in the next few years find some way to really scale looking at those highly individual things in each person. That's the way I'm seeing it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty, eye opening in a lot of ways. And you know, I guess like the bottlenecks also vary in degrees. Someone has a very more serious bottleneck, and the other one might not notice anything. Like subjectively, they don't feel that they have a bottleneck, but they might do. So yeah, like there's a huge degree and range in this well.
Yeah, I totally 100% agree with that. But even still, let's say that, consider this nonlinearity, right? Like, let's say that your carbohydrate metabolism works good enough that you don't notice any problems on 1.1 milligrams of thiamine per day, but you are otherwise supercharged because you have done everything right and all your other genes make you a high-level athlete that will probably live to 120 years old. Mm-hmm. Right, but you have one problem in your carbohydrate metabolism that will only work correctly in the presence of 500 milligrams of thiamine a day. You might not ever notice any problems, but once you've taken home the silver in some Olympic sport, it's quite possible that like the one thing that you could do to get gold is actually add the 500 milligrams of thiamine.
Right.
That you didn't know you needed to optimize your carbohydrate metabolism, because it doesn't matter to your blood sugar on a day-to-day life, but damn straight, it matters when you're trying to be one fraction of a second faster than the next person. And the way that you get faster in that moment is to burn a little extra carbohydrate. Right. And like, also, maybe that's the way that you get your extra 10 years. Maybe you'll live to 95 and maybe you would have lived to 105 if you had figured out the thiamine thing. Like, and it's so it's not you're not trying to solve a problem so much as it becomes you don't really need to optimize this last piece, but that last piece might be the piece that really makes like a high impact puzzle fit together that you didn't know was there,
Right. So you are working on that. Do you know like any other companies right now that do the whole genome sequencing?
There are a number. I have used Dante Labs for myself and a number of clients this year. only in the last month, I've been getting complaints from several clients that their Dante results are taking longer than they should, and they're not getting an explanation for it. And I know Nebula is another company that a lot of people have been using, and I haven't gotten a chance to use them myself or analyze any genomes from it. But from my perspective, it doesn't really matter. It's whole genome is whole genome, and anything else is everything else. And I'm not at the point yet where I can say this company is better than that company. I was using Dante just because a few other people had used it. They were getting results from it. So I was like, oh, I'll do that for myself. I was getting results from it. So I started recommending it to other people. They were getting results from it. But it doesn't, the company doesn't matter that much, though. It's the whole genome sequencing methodology that differentiates whole genome from all the other stuff. And the company, like maybe the quality of their reports differs or their customer service differs, but the make or break thing is that it's whole genome sequencing.
Gotcha. Right.
And you know, the thing, because think of it this way too. It's not an all or nothing thing that you learned everything from your genome. Like if you just get all the reports that are available now, there's a certain amount of information you can learn from that, but you still have the whole genome sequenced. And so that can be the basis for reports that company issues in the future, or can be the basis of working with me in the future on a deeper analysis of the raw data or whatever it is. You're not limited to whatever the reports currently are in that sense.
Right. Yeah. I think, yeah, we've been going pretty deep with all these topics, and I don't want to like go into another rabbit hole with another topic like choline or TMAO and those things, so we'll do like another future episode about that. But yeah, like, is there anything else you want to add to the end before we stop?
Not really. I mean, I would just, I guess, summarize a bit and say that when you're looking at longevity, I think the first thing that you want to look at is a time-dependent, probability-dependent strategy to make it through all the causes of death. And when you're young, you want to be thinking about putting on peak bone mass and peak muscle mass, and you want to be thinking about injury prevention, right? Because I would say through life, and this becomes more important when you're older, but it's much better to start when you're younger. You know, if you're starting out in your 20s training, I would sooner rather than later start maybe meeting with a physical therapist once a year who's qualified to do a functional movement screen, or some other type of movement therapist who's qualified to do a functional movement screen, and work on high quality movement and injury prevention at that point. Because when, you know, if you imagine the person who falls and breaks their hip and dies a year later, there's numerous things going on. And it wasn't just about bone density or muscle mass. It was also about neuromuscular control and movement patterns. And I mean, and there's so much suffering that goes alongside that, like chronic back pain and stuff that you would also not be dealing with when you get to that age if you've thought about those things. So I think starting young, you really want to be thinking about muscle mass, bone mass, and high quality movement patterns that are checked by an expert in functional movement patterns. I think going forward to think about diabetes, like respiratory infections and diabetes, I think mostly comes down to having a good diet on factors that most diet war camps would probably agree on, right? Like if you find the consensus among the paleo, vegan, carnivore, South Beach, Atkins, whatever is the new thing is, like, the obvious things, like mostly eat whole foods, eat well-rounded enough to get all your nutrients. And I think that plus the movement stuff that I just mentioned is probably the strongest diabetes prevention pack that you can have. And I think getting good nutrition is generally going to cover most infections. And heart disease, I think you can layer on some stuff with, like, look at your blood lipids and tweak that a bit. I think cancer is a lot more, there's a much greater controversy over cancer, but I think most of these things are also going to protect you in that realm. And I think, eat well, move well, get outside, get good sunshine, properly sleep, and manage stress. That bucket, I think when you check those boxes and you've checked the, like, the sort of specific boxes along the line of disease prevention, I think after that, it's you want to better understand your uniqueness. And I don't want it to come across as super hopeless in terms of the last conversation that we had, where it's like, I'm going into the raw data of esoteric genetic analysis to find the next thing. I strongly stand by everything that I said there, but if you want kind of a poor man's version of finding genetic idiosyncrasies, I think self-experimentation is the key to that, right? So rather than looking at a mouse study of, like, do carbohydrates make mice live longer, I think you want to say, do I have good body composition, good blood sugar, and feel well on a high carb diet or on a low carb diet? And you can do that with carbs, you can do it with protein, you can do it with fat, and you can do it with types of foods, and you can do it with supplements. And if you can find the sweet spot between effortless good body composition and feeling well, on the and there's various things you can look at. You can look at your blood pressure, you can look at your blood sugar, you can look at how often do you get sick, you can look at, do I feel rested when I wake up in the morning, you can look at, do I feel fatigued all day or do I feel good? All those very general things, boxes you could check about being able to confidently say, yes, I am a healthy person. When if you self-experiment and find where that sweet spot is for you, I think that is more accessible, more empowering, and ultimately higher quality, both than taking longevity mouse studies and generalizing them to yourself and looking at 40 reports of 500,000 out of the 6 million polymorphisms that you have and getting, 300 pages of things that you should do with your diet, right? Like, I think just simplifying it and saying, experimenting and saying, like, where is the sweet spot for me is probably going to be the simple way to find the genetic idiosyncrasies that we were talking about in the data intensive way.
Yeah, I agree. Like the mice and other animals, in the lab environment, they live in a completely different setting, and I don't think like anyone would like to swap places with those animals, even if they live longer. Like being hungry and the scientists are injecting you with different stuff or putting like under cold or heat or whatever. So it's not like a fun life to live for sure in those laboratory environments. But
Yeah,
yeah.
especially if there's no hamster wheel in the cage.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it was great talking with you, and yeah, we'll probably do like another one in the future about
Cool.
other topics.
Yeah, I'd love to.
All right. It was great talking with you.
All right, take care, man.
But do you want to slow down aging and live longer? If yes, then I'm looking for more people who want to reverse their biological clock. If you're interested, then email me the word health to info@seamland.com and I'll send you the details.